Previously on Beta.
Breakfast come and go, Renee. Now Hartford, the Whale. Hey, they only beat Vancouver once, maybe twice in a lifetime.
It began with a sound that no one was ever supposed to hear.
Our Lady of Blessed Acceleration, don't fail me now!
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, author Sheila Weller talks about how Carrie Fisher's iconic role as Princess Leia in Star Wars changed her life and the lives of others.
Young women who saw it, you know, whether they used the word or not, consciously or unconsciously, they saw a feminist heroine in that role.
Speaking of Star Wars, ever wonder how they created the voice of Chewbacca?
One day they recorded this young bear, a cub, named Pooh. The way that they got him to make sounds is that he liked bread. It would be like dunked in milk or something, and then they'd show it to him, and then he'd want it, and then he'd kind of cry out for it, and then they'd give him the bread, and then he'd make these great sounds.
Mitch Kosten is the director of the documentary film Making Waves, The Art of Cinematic Sound. Why all the Star Wars content, you ask? Why not? I respond irreverently. It's a Star Wars galaxy. We just live in it. But first, John Hodgman. John is a writer, comedian, and actor. You might remember him from The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. He's also the host of the Judge John Hodgman podcast and the author of several books. His latest is Medallion Status: True Stories from Secret Rooms. The book talks about his unexpected rise to stardom, life after The Daily Show, and his fascination with extinct hockey.
I'm from Massachusetts originally, so I grew up in the close company of Connecticut and the Hartford Whalers.
Yes.
The only major league sport that poor Connecticut ever got.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, lost in the mid-90s. They became the Carolina Hurricanes.
Yeah.
Now, I didn't come at it. I didn't come at extinct hockey and my fandom of this poor lost team, the Hartford Whalers, through any appreciation of either sports or marine mammals. I came at it because the logo is so striking and beautiful and sort of late 70s in its aesthetic and blocky and interesting and clean. You know, there's a – so basically I love hockey for graphic design reasons. You know,
mm-hmm. Because you saw someone – you saw – as you write in the book, you saw someone with a Hartford Whalers logo tattoo, right? And you didn't know what it was at the time, right?
Well, I know I remembered the logo from when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
But I hadn't seen it for a long, long time.
I see.
It's designed by a guy named Peter Good. He's mm-hmm. still a graphic designer in West Hartford. He and his wife, Jan Cummings, have a design firm that prior to the Whalers, they had never designed any sports identity of any kind. They only designed like posters for art museums and jazz brunches.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically what the Hartford Whalers logo looks like.
Well, yeah.
And it's got this very clean design and it's got this beautiful – I had never realized until I saw this guy with the tattoo – and then went to look it up again and remind myself of this logo and its history, that there was between the whale's tail and the W that form the two main graphic images of the design, there is negative space that forms an H.
Yes, it's great use of negative space. It's as you say in the book, I believe, it is one of the best logos. It's right up there. And their use of the use of negative space in that is on par with, I would say, the use of negative space in the FedEx logo, that hidden arrow.
Yeah. That arrow that no one ever sees until you point it out to them. It's like a magic trick.
Exactly, yeah.
Even though I am not a sports fan, I'm willing to go to a sports bar and get into a fight about it. Whereas the Nordiques logo as graphic design, it's the worst. It's so bad, it's beautiful.
Mm, yeah, well said.
It looks like a deformed elephant, but it's supposed to look like an ant.
It does, yeah. Yeah, I'd like to play just a bit of Name That Tune with you. Can you name this tune?
You don't have to play it anymore.
Okay, so you know what it is. What is it?
I knew it from the blah.
So, well, yeah. So,
that's Brass Bonanza.
Yeah, the song that
is the song that they would play when the Hartford Whalers got a goal. You can't come at me with extinct hockey trivia.
I didn't think. But the reason I wanted to come at you with extinct hockey trivia, John, is because I couldn't believe, for me, I guess you're not as crazy about the song as I am. And you're not as crazy as
great.
Me, period. But why would you not mention it in the book? Did the editor take it out? Or you just...
I didn't find it. Did I not mention it in the book?
No, that's why I thought, Jesus, because is it possible he doesn't know? about the, you know?
No, I know.
Yeah, that's what
I
know. Well, I'm glad we settled
Brass
that.
Bonanza. It's a great song.
It's a great song, yeah.
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 You know what? I should have at least put it on the audiobook.
Yeah,
so
you should.
Could
yeah,
hear
absolutely.
It, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Anyway, that yeah. Yeah, when
the
it's
Hurricanes, the Hurricanes play wearing Hartford Whalers.
Yes, occasionally. Yeah,
time.
That's like a third jersey.
Just to ice skate on their grave, I guess.
And yeah, exactly. And you know why they do that? Because of you. You don't follow the trends, you set the trends.
Look, Peter Good made the logo.
Yeah.
This other guy got the tattoo, got me thinking about it. Then I started talking about it and wearing it. I can't say that I'm single-handedly responsible for the.
I think you could. You're just too modest.
The success of the extinct Hartford Whalers.
Oh, you're just too humble and modest. But anyway, let's move from lake ice hockey now to the title of your latest book, Medallion Status, now available at bookstores everywhere, also available on audiobook, read by John Hodgman.
Hodgman, that's
yes,
me.
Exactly. Yeah. So where does the title come from?
Well, it is literally to the point that I was worried that I would get a cease and desist letter. It is a reference to Delta Airlines loyalty program. The more you fly with any airline, obviously you know they want to keep you flying with them, so they award you what are called miles, which you can then trade in for nothing, basically. If you have 1 million miles, you might be able to get a one-way ticket to Toledo for free. But they also award you a separate brand of miles in Delta, in particular, called medallion qualifying miles. And so medallion status is a legitimate, you know, medallion status is a direct reference to this loyalty program, but it also becomes in the book a metaphor for being seen. You know, I used to be on television on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart when it was The Daily Show with Jon Stewart before Trevor Noah and took over the program so ably. And it was one of the most recognizable and rightly so television shows in the nation, if not the world. And so I spent a lot of time being recognized in a way that I never expected to. Anyone who has ever looked at my face will know that my on-camera career is wildly implausible. Basically, I went on the show to promote my book, and John kidnapped me and put me on television for the next 9 years.
I guess, welcome to the show, John Hodgman. John Hodgman, everybody.
Nice to see you, John. Good to see you. Thanks for stopping by and joining us.
And now, is the camera on me? Good,
yes.
Thank you. John, the reason I called you here today.
Well, I'm here every day. It's my show, so I'm here. It's not like you.
Please, John, this is hard enough without your blubbering. I have something to say. I've been appearing on this show for almost 10 years now, and this show doesn't deserve an even slightly restless, deranged billionaire.
What?
And so I'm moving on.
Really?
The point is, I'm retiring to an exclusive gated community.
Wow, you're going to Florida?
But no, John, an exclusive gated community on Mars. But, you know, people stopping me on the street saying it's John Hodgman became part of my life. And that was part of the way I came to understood how important it and how powerful it is to be seen and acknowledged and recognized and how rare it is that in most people's lives, they're never seen and they're never recognized for who they are or want to be, often not even within their own families. So the medallion status becomes a metaphor for something bigger that I'm trying to explore in the book, as well as also just telling funny stories of my life.
You're not, as you mentioned, you're not on television anymore. I'm curious, what do you miss most about acting? Or do you
snacks.
Miss anything?
The snacks.
The snacks? Tell me about why.
What's craft so great services.
About? Do you have a favorite craft service snack?
You know, cubes of cheese. Look, this is part of the reason why I love the airline exclusive sky lounges, you know, because they often have trays of cubed cheese for me. That's one of the greatest things that can happen in my life.
Yeah, and as you say, as you write in your book, the Sky Lounge is not aspirational. It is desperational. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, being on television, even at the minor, very minor level of fame that I had, it affords you all kinds of entree into exclusive parties, secret societies, hidden rooms, private clubs, and these sky clubs being kind of the most accessible of them. These secret societies where sad business dads meet and drink, you know, a Bud Light at 10 a.m. in the morning.
This is
a place for people who are terrified of death because they're about to get into a multi-ton tube full of people and their farts and float above the earth impossibly for hours on end to load up on something to make them less scared.
Yeah.
And that's why I say that the Sky Clubs, you know, the Sky Clubs are not aspirational. Like so many other secret clubs, they are actually desperational. You're They're right. a place to hide and feel nervous in.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Well, one of my favorite chapters in your book is called Disney Jail. Can you tell me the story behind Disney Jail?
Yeah, so, you know, to pay for the time that I had spent away and to, in an attempt to regain their love, I took my kids to Disneyland. And as we were walking through Disneyland, I met an actor who actually is a cast member at Disneyland sometimes. He works there. And he mentioned casually in passing Disney Jail. And both my son and I were like, hold on, stop walking. What are you talking about? What is Disney Jail? And it's like, that's the place where we take the people at Disneyland who get out of hand. Maybe they're having a hard day, or they got real drunk and stood up naked on a Dumbo or something. I don't know. And my son and I were fascinated with Disney Jail. We're like, what does it look like? Is it like in the back of the fake police station in Main Street, USA? Who goes there? Why do they go there? And then my son asked me a question. Hypothetically, what if you had to go down? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If you had to go to Disney Jail, what would be the best way to go out? Like, what would be the thing to do in order to get out?
Yeah.
And my son, we had a couple of different things about, you know, standing up in the Pirates of the Caribbean and, you know, screaming at the animatronics, abominations, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
My son had one that was great, which was like, what if I wander by myself into Fantasyland and in tears, crying for my mommy and daddy? Because he knew, and I knew, and maybe some of your listeners know, that in Fantasyland, you know, that's where the Snow White stuff is, right?
Yes.
And on a second floor window in Fantasyland, every now and then an animatronic evil queen will part the curtains and look out over the land,
mm-hmm.
and then close the curtains. And only people who are in the know this, right? So my son was like, what if I go out into the middle of Fantasyland crying, where's my mommy? Where's my mommy? Until some nice family goes, we'll help you find your mommy. And then my son will look up and point at that window as the curtains part and sees the animatronic and goes, no, that's my mommy. I've brought another family for you, mommy. That was my son's joke.
That's
He's 11
great.
Years old. It's incredible.
Takes after the old man. I have a thought experiment for you. If, nay, when you were to have your own theme park called, I don't know, let's say Hodgman Land, what kinds of lands and attractions would it feature?
I know exactly where it would happen.
Where would it happen?
Well, I host a podcast called Judge John Hodgman.
Yes,
And the podcast is sort of my humorous riff on a Judge Judy type show.
Mm-hmm.
People call in with actual disputes, and I resolve them, and I say who's right and who's wrong. And one time, a couple called in from Germany, and their dispute was over whether or not to get an air conditioner because the boyfriend in this heterosexual couple who grew up in Germany had never had an air conditioner and thought they were stupid. And the girlfriend in this couple had only had air conditioners and she wanted one. So it was a cultural issue. But all of that is boring and mm-hmm. became instantly boring to me when the guy mentioned that they almost visited a former Zeppelin hangar that has been turned into a massive indoor water park.
Ah.
And I was like, how dare you not go?
Yeah.
How dare you not go to that?
Yeah.
Because it's this massive dome that has its own world inside of it. I think you can even take a hot air balloon inside of the dome. Like, and it was a Zeppelin factory. It was touching a lot of buttons for me in terms of esoteric mm-hmm. culture. And my dream at that moment was not to make a John Hodgman land, but instead to create one of my favorite movies is Moonrise Kingdom. One of my favorite directors is Wes mm-hmm. Anderson.
Yes.
And so many of his movies are essentially theme parks.
Yes.
They're highly and carefully themed onto like the precise height of the tube socks that they wear in the Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou.
Yes.
And I was just like, I would like to create a Wes Anderson themed theme park. Because if you had a Wes Anderson themed theme park, it would be the culmination of his work. I think
mm-hmm.
that you could actually go and live in this weird eccentric white 13-year-old pretentious nerd's head, but also you could call it either Wes Anderson Land, well, or Wes Anderland.
Oh, that's
or
nice.
Or you could call it Westworld.
Oh, like that's Westworld. Very nice. That's
See
perfect.
What I mean?
Yeah, beautiful.
So that's the idea. I can't think of anything besides that. That's the only theme park idea I've got in my head. What would happen in John Hodgman land? There would be a recreation of Brookline, Massachusetts, where I grew up, and there would be the Coolidge Corner Movie Theater where I worked and became a fan of filmed entertainment.
Special status lands that only high status people would be able to get into. Hodgman land would be the statusiest place on earth.
Disneyland has its secret Club 33 that you can only join. You can only attend if you're a member, and I would have like Club 34.
Yeah, like, and flight attendants of the Caribbean, the Hall of Hobos. You got to have the Hall of Hobos.
See, this is the thing. You are already thinking about it.
I know.
Why did you ask me this question? You wanted to answer the question.
No, I wanted to collaborate.
I'm very flattered.
No, I'm very flattered. But anyway, I have one final question about, as you mentioned, you have this Judge John Hodgman podcast. And speaking of that, just so happens that a few years ago, Wisconsin Public Radio's very own radio operations manager, Aubrey Ralph, submitted their very own pressing issue. And here's a clip.
Oh.
Aubrey writes, "My partner Ginger and I have a long-running argument. Is it okay to go into a restaurant that's 10 minutes from the official closing time? Ginger thinks it's a huge burden to the waitstaff to have a patron come in just before closing. I spent about 10 years in food service. On a slow night, latecomers can be a little annoying, but it's all just part of the job. Plus, people who come in late are often great tippers. I say that if a restaurant wanted to have all patrons out by 10 or whenever, they should have set an earlier closing time. Judge Hodgman, please settle this for us."
Well, first of all, Aubrey and Ginger, your names are delightful, and I would think fictional.
Mm-hmm.
You sound like a pair of snakes in a children's book. And the two snakes go to the restaurant, and it's 10 minutes before closing, and the host or hostess at the restaurant looks at them and goes, "This is why everyone thinks snakes are jerks. Don't go to a restaurant 10 minutes before closing and order a full meal. I don't care how long you worked in food service; you should know better." Sorry, Aubrey.
I can assure you that Aubrey and Ginger's names are not fictional, and they are not snakes. So,
this is a colleague of yours. That's
right,
wonderful.
Right, he's in the control room right now. But can Aubrey appeal your verdict to the Hodgman Court of Appeals or Supreme Court? Is there any mechanism in place?
No, there is no. Aww. There is no. My justice is final.
Okay.
And also, but Aubrey should take heart because my justice is also unenforceable. It's a podcast. Who cares? Nothing's going to happen. I mean, basically, the Judge John Hodgman podcast, while it can be very hard and fast with regard to social conventions, etiquette, how people relate to each other in relationships, the most important thing I hope that people take away from the Judge John Hodgman podcast is that people should, rather than trying to ascertain rules, because rules allow you to move through the world without talking to other people or negotiating your space with other people, but instead be open and discuss whatever the issue might be. So, you know, lots of people call in, they're like, "I need a hard and fast rule about whether it's okay just this one example, you know, like to go in to a restaurant really late." And if I say, "Yeah, it's fine," that's not going to make the kitchen staff happy when you actually go and do it, Aubrey. They're going to be mad. And you're going to say, like, "Guess what? There is a rule on the podcast." Like, they're not going to work for them.
Yeah.
Instead, I try to coax out these conflicts that are sometimes seem very superficial, but there's deep stuff behind them, and generally encourage people to just talk to other human beings and hear their point of view.
Exactly. Very well said. John Hodgman, thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
John Hodgman is a writer, actor, comedian, and the host of the Judge John Hodgman podcast. His latest book is called Medallion Status: True Stories from Secret Rooms. Find out more about John at wpr.org/beta.
When she said in December 2000 to Diane Sawyer, "I am mentally ill, I can say that," that broke some barriers. It really did. It relieved a lot of people who were, especially women, who were hiding what they had and would stay home from work and make excuses.
Author Sheila Weller joins us to talk about the life and career of Carrie Fisher. That's coming up in a minute. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. The latest installment of the Star Wars saga, Star Wars: The Rise of Skywalker, features Carrie Fisher's final performance as Princess Leia Organa. Carrie lived a full life. In addition to acting, she was also an acclaimed writer and feminist icon. She was open about her struggles with drugs and mental illness. Carrie died suddenly of cardiac arrest on December 27, 2016. She was 60. Biographer Sheila Weller has written about Carrie Fisher's remarkable life, from Hollywood royalty to Princess Leia and beyond, in Carrie Fisher, A Life on the Edge. Sheila talked about Carrie's famous parents, movie star Debbie Reynolds and singer Eddie Fisher.
She had a lot of privilege around her, a lot of glamour, and also there was a big scandal that erupted when she was about 2 years old. Her father kind of ran off with Elizabeth Taylor, who was a family friend. Their marriage had been the perfect 50s marriage, so to speak. The adorable girl from Texas, who was a singer-dancer, and the handsome crooner from Philadelphia. She was very Christian. He was Jewish. I think America in the conventional 50s was happy that they could break one little taboo by watching this adorable couple marry across regional and religious lines. But they were the adorable couple in movie magazines and in other magazines. And then suddenly he fell in love with this beautiful woman who had just been widowed, and everything erupted. I mean, it was an extraordinary scandal. You know, in America, it was a story that housewives and everybody kind of sunk their teeth into. And Carrie grew up with lights flashing, you know, in her eyes as a little girl with paparazzi on the front lawn. Mm-hmm. I think her grandfather once yielded a rifle against the paparazzi. So it was a huge public event, and it also was a hurtful event. Her father left her and her mother.
Yeah. Most of us first came to know of Carrie Fisher from her role as Princess Leia Organa in George Lucas's 1977 blockbuster Star Wars. And she played an aggressive and assertive heroine, not a damsel in distress type.
Right.
Did Lucas write the character of Princess Leia this way, or is this something that Carrie brought to the role?
That's a good question. She certainly brought it. Later, she started improvising her own lines, and she would go to be in movies and immediately tear up the script, and the producers and directors thought and actors thought what she was doing was much better than was on the page. But at the beginning, she was not a writer. She was a young girl. But she had an attitude, a hauteur, that gave her that non-damsel in distress attitude. And it worked. And young women who saw it saw a, you know, whether they used the word or not, consciously or unconsciously, they saw a feminist heroine in that role. She took a lot of licks for the guys. She was stronger than they were in many ways. She was a princess, so she had that grandeur about her. And she got into dangerous situations and got herself out of them, and she killed Jabba the Hutt.
Yeah, and she had that iconic hairstyle, the kind of buns on the, mm-hmm. both sides of her head. There's that line in Star Wars, The Last Jedi, the scene where Princess Leia is being reunited with her long-lost brother Luke, and that great line that she says to him.
I know what you're gonna say. I changed my hair.
It's nice that way.
Carrie met singer-songwriter Paul Simon while she was filming Star Wars, and they dated from 1977 until 1980 and then broke up, and then they got back together and they married in August 1983. What was their relationship like?
She met him, I think, through Richard Dreyfuss. I think he might have come to see her in Star Wars as well. There are two versions of that. Richard told me that he introduced them. She had been singing Bridge Over Troubled Water in grammar school and in high school and in Las Vegas and in London with her mother. That was her favorite song. She adored his music and his literacy. They were both short, and she made jokes about that. Don't stand next to me. They'll think we're salt and pepper shakers. They were both very verbal and witty. He was calmer. He was more serious. She was much younger and incredibly smart. People said you could see the infatuation. It was incredibly strong. She was very self-assured, and she had her own money, she had her own privilege, she had her own sophistication. He wasn't used to that kind of package, people said. Mm. He had other women who were strong and other women who were interesting and sophisticated, but not quite as young and as full of just dynamism and questions about the world and a kind of turbulence of the soul that Carrie had. So she was challenging in a number of ways, and he was definitely the calmer one. She said later that she felt a bit less than around his sophisticated friends. She hadn't finished high school. She only left in her junior year, so she almost finished and did some remedial school in New York, but felt a little insecure about that. But everybody thought she was incredibly smart. but it was a relationship that was full of love.
Mm. As you write in your book, Carrie said that the bad thing about their relationship was that they were similar animals. How so?
I think she said in a relationship you need a plant and a waterer, and we were both plants. We both needed watering. They both had demands. She had a big ego. She had a big sense of herself. She wasn't just somebody who was going to help a man and be kind and sweet and gentle and, you know, yes, dear, what do you want? No, dear, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And even though he was a representative of the new generation and the counterculture and the literate counterculture, men in the 70s still had the template of earlier generations. And that would last for a long time, which was that the woman is a little bit beholden to you, that you're a little bit the primary person in the relationship. So I think that was challenging for him. And she wrote about that and talked about that.
Can you talk a bit about Carrie Fisher's overuse of drugs and how that impacted her life?
It impacted her life quite a bit. Her father was an addict. I think we can say that. He had a predisposition to overuse of drugs. There's a genetic link to it. It's not always that way, but I think in her case it was. In the 70s, you know, a lot of people were doing cocaine as a quote-unquote recreational drug. Some people like Carrie and John Belushi, for them it couldn't have been just a recreational drug. It was something that was hard to give up. And also she had bipolar disorder, which was then called manic depression, but it wasn't diagnosed as such. So during manic stages, she would take what was then called painkillers and now are called opioids. So it was challenging for her, and she fought it and gave into it and fought it and gave into it for much of her life.
And I believe that the diagnosis of bipolar 2 or manic depression, that came in 1981 when she overdosed on the set of a film Under the Rainbow that she was making with Chevy Chase. Is that right?
That was the first one. Yes, she rejected that diagnosis, and later, after another overdose, she accepted it, was very clean for about 11 months, and took it very seriously, you know, and accepted the diagnosis, indeed.
In 1987, Carrie released her first book, Postcards from the Edge, a semi-autobiographical novel. Why did she decide to write this book?
Well, I think she always wanted to be a writer. As a young girl, she read the great writers. She really admired Dorothy Parker and others, and after this and a couple of other books, she said, I'm not an actor who writes, I'm a writer who acts. It was gathering in her. First, she was going to write a book called Money Dearest, which was kind of a funny take on growing up in Beverly Hills, but she thought that was a little too sardonic. I think the situation with the overdose and her strong understanding and witty understanding of being a woman in Hollywood, being a woman at that time and place, what the Hollywood culture was like, her own sense of the world, came together, and she wanted to write it, and she did.
In your book, you include an excerpt from Postcards from the Edge in which Carrie describes what it felt like to live in her brain. Could you read this for us?
Mm-hmm. She lived in her head like a mad woman locked in a tower, hearing the wind howling through her hair and waiting for someone to come and rescue her from feeling things so deeply that her bones burned.
Thank you. That's very powerful.
Yeah.
Now, this will really, really impress you. I am in the abnormal psychology textbook. How cool is that? Now, keep in mind, I am a Pez dispenser, and I'm in the abnormal psychology textbook. Who says you can't have it all?
In 2006, Carrie put together a one-woman stage show with writer-director Joshua Ravitch. The show was called Wishful Drinking. Can you tell me a bit about that show?
Yes, that was a wonderful show. It went on for years. She had a board with a pointer of her crazy family and all the relationships. She talked about being weight-shamed, being age-shamed. She made fun of herself in a way that was so hilarious. Women especially midlife women, felt relief in it. They felt, here was a celebrity who was making fun of the same things that I feel secretly ashamed of, being overweight, being older than I would like to be.
Well, but here's the thing. As you age, it's about dignity. You know what I mean? This is what you have to look forward to. It's really unavoidable. George Lucas ruined my life. I mean that in the nicest possible way. And now, he hardly talked at all. When I got this job,
They told me that I had to lose 10 pounds. Well, I weighed about 105 at the time. Well, no, but to be fair now, I carried about 50 of those pounds in my face. So you know what a good idea would be, though? Give me a hairstyle that further widens my already wide face.
She took herself to task. She talked about the quote-unquote contract she signed to look always the way she looked in the metal bikini. And she said, clearly, I broke the contract. You know, so when you're young and beautiful and thin, and that is an iconic portrait, and you change and you grow and you live and you go through challenges and you gain weight, it's hard when you're a public figure. And this was when social media was beginning and getting very active. And she became a big Twitterer, especially toward the end of her life. But it was painful to have people say things like, Carrie Fisher used to be so hot, now she looks like Elton John.
Oh, it's terrible.
And she spoke about that in Wishful Drinking, yeah. So she made fun of it, but toward the end of her life, it was sad to her.
Yeah, and it was a big hit, right? Audiences responded really well to Wishful Drinking.
Big hit all over the world. And she did it when she was in the middle of many challenges. She had ECT, electroconvulsive therapy, in the middle of that period of time. And it was amazing. I think she never missed a performance.
Wow.
She had a lot going on, but like her mother, she was unsinkable. The show must go on.
The unsinkable Molly Brown, the unsinkable Carrie Fisher. An HBO documentary called Bright Lights, starring Carrie Fisher and Debbie Reynolds, was released a couple of years ago. What can we learn from this film about Carrie's relationship with her mother?
How complex and deep and loving it was. It was a beautiful documentary. You saw Debbie struggling. She was ill at the time. She wanted to keep performing. You saw that Iron Maiden in Debbie and Carrie learning from Debbie, Debbie learning from Carrie, them going together when Debbie won one of her major awards and Carrie being so awed and appreciative that her mother won the award. They had had a turbulent relationship earlier on, especially when she was in London going to college at the Central School of Speech and Drama. So this showed how incredibly close they became in the final years, maybe the final couple of decades of their lives.
I don't know what to go another world. One of these days, you will see me. I don't know the song.
I'll be around.
I think I'm my mom's best friend, more than a daughter. My mother really wants me to be an extension of her wishes, an extension of her. And to a great degree, far more sometimes than I ever would want to, I know what my mother feels and wants. And there's a lot of it.
And they lived in two houses in one compound in Coldwater Canyon. And they were just amazingly close. And a lot of women who saw it thought, that's a version of me and my mother in one way or another.
It resonated with them.
Right.
Can you take us through the last day of Carrie Fisher's life and tell us what happened?
Well, the night before, she had dinner with Salman Rushdie, her friend, and Sharon Horgan, with whom she was in Catastrophe. She had a good evening, according to these two people, although there was a sadness about her that was developing. She said to Sharon Horgan at one point, I'm sorry that I didn't hold it together better with her looks, words to that effect. The next day, she got up, went to the airport to take a plane to L.A., and she had a seizure, fortunately close to landing in L.A. It wasn't in the middle of the flight. And there was an episode of sleep apnea, and it brought on a heart attack. And she was taken immediately to the hospital, was put on some sort of life support for a couple of days, and then she died.
And her mother, Debbie Reynolds, died the day after.
Yes.
Carrie.
Yes.
What do you make of that?
Everybody sort of made of it kind of Shakespearean, biblical. You know, according to Todd Fisher, it was almost destined to happen. Debbie had been very sick the last year, and Carrie was taking care of Debbie and worried about Debbie. And Debbie had been worried about Carrie, kind of all of Carrie's life. Carrie had that intense personality, that complexity that was the undiagnosed bipolar. And Debbie knew that she had periods of great vulnerability and said once, and I quoted it twice in the book, if I could, I would suffer for her. You know, Todd Fisher has said that was something that was inevitable, that she felt it was her time to go. And I think a lot of people who knew their relationship kind of understood that.
Sheila Weller, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sheila Weller is the author of Carrie Fisher, A Life on the Edge. Find out more about Sheila and the remarkable life of Carrie Fisher at WPR.org/beta.
You do absolutely no sound, so you're leaning forward, and then she looks up and you hear her breath, and then the wings of the birds come at you, and you're just like, you just want to duck, you know? It's so frightening.
Director Midge Costin joins us to talk about her documentary, Making Waves, The Art of Cinematic Sound. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and you're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. When it comes to film, we always talk about how things look. So it's not surprising that when we discuss our favorite scenes, we talk about the way the actors look, the camera angles, and the art direction. But do we ever talk about listening to a film? Think of the way Orson Welles whispers, "Rosebud," in Citizen Kane, or the masterful way that Walter Murch used sound in Francis Ford Coppola's Apocalypse Now. I love the sound of helicopters in the morning. Our next guest makes the case that sound design is just as important to the success of a film. Midge Costin is the producer and director of a documentary called Making Waves, The Art of Cinematic Sound.
I was a sound editor for years in Hollywood. I went to film school, and the last thing I thought I would do coming out of school was sound. Because when I was in school, I didn't relate it to story and character, and I felt like it was more like an engineering thing and technical, and so it kind of put me off. And then I came out of school, and I had everything done, but I had my thesis film left. And a friend of mine who I had cut a student film with had turned into a sound editor. And one day he called me up and said, Midge, none of the union guys will touch this 16-millimeter film that came in, but it was with a big producer. So he said, if you come in, I'll show you how to cut effects. And as I tell my students, you know, I lowered myself and took a sound job because I needed the money to finish my thesis.
Right.
And then here I am on the show, and it's like, I'm the only effects editor. So I'm like, oh my God, I got to set this mood and the tone. I've got to figure out, like, how do I even think about sound with character? And, you know, and at least I had learned in film school I would be responsible to break down those sounds. But I had just never really gone into detail in sound at school. Right from that very first show, I started to realize how much you add to the movie. And then that editor called me up one day and said, he was going on to work on a TV show. Would I take over on this kind of B movie? Maybe it was a C or D movie. Mm-hmm. So I said, who's doing the sound? And he said, we don't know yet. And I said, I'll take it if I can be supervising sound editor. And that just, like, my career, you know, just kind of took off. But also, here's the thing that I learned, Doug, when I was interviewing all these great sound designers, they all at some point had, like, some kind of tape recorder or something. When I was in fifth grade, for Christmas, I got a little, like, reel-to-reel tape recorder, and I would do all these shows and record things, and I had to think back to that and think, wow, yeah, I guess it was always kind of sound-oriented.
Yeah. You went on to collaborate on the soundtracks for many filmmakers, like John Waters, Crybaby, Kenneth Branagh's film, Dead Again, Tony Scott, Crimson Tide. What is your personal philosophy for what makes good sound design for a film?
It's all about the story. If the director and producers really need to give the sound people enough time, like give somebody a script.
Yeah.
And then you can start thinking about it because, you know, just like the visuals, it's like you're thinking in metaphor. How can you tell this story, reflect character, plot points and everything? And you really need to, you know, think through every frame. And we need to do the same thing with sound.
Yeah, there's this great soundbite from David Lynch near the beginning of your film. He says that
people always talk about the look of a film. They don't talk so much about the sound of a film. But it's equally important, sometimes more important.
Do you think that your film can help to get more people talking about the sound of movies?
Oh, definitely. It's so fun when I run into people now who've seen the movie, and even weeks or months later, they'll say how they're watching films, like, differently. But also in their lives, they think about sound. And one of my favorite things was coming out of the premiere in L.A., and there were these five, like, law students who were, you know, standing on the sidewalk with one of our lawyers. And I said, how'd you like the film? They said, wow, we're just standing here talking about how the traffic is affecting us. But before we saw the movie, we never would have thought, like, how much it's really affecting affecting how we feel right now.
Yeah. One of the people in your film is Teresa Exton, who worked on, the, among other things, the sound effects editing on Steven Spielberg's Saving Private Ryan. What did Teresa tell you about editing sound effects?
Oh, well, she's fantastic. She really thought about the sounds in, you know, in the battle scenes. Like, you're always creating, like, outside the frame. That's really our responsibility. And you really have to work it out. The easy part is almost doing what's on the frame, and then you have to think of where is everything and what would be happening, what would they be listening to? Is it distracting to the story? But Teresa, it was really interesting where she talks about, you know, you have to keep that battle alive, but you don't just do it arbitrarily. You're really, it's like creating music. Like, there's no music in those scenes until the end of it. And so she's really creating, like, the rhythm, you know, really like the music to the scene almost.
There's this great clip from Steven Spielberg where he's talking about a particular scene from the opening sequence of Saving Private Ryan.
So I designed a sequence where when an explosion hits near Captain Miller, all the sound goes out. And that came from an actual veteran that told me that was how it affected him. So it put you deep inside his experience.
What the hell do we do now, sir?
One of the things that Spielberg will do is really focus on, you know, something that sound is telling the story. Mm. And so he did this really strong point of view. When you do that, you really focus on what's happening. It's kind of otherworldly. And to hear nothing but to see these horrific sounds, it almost makes it more terrifying.
Yes. One of the pioneers, probably the pioneer of the way sound is used in movies these days, is Walter Murch. Can you talk about how Walter Murch changed the way movies sounded?
Yeah, Walter's so interesting because he wasn't interested in films until really he went to France and then saw the French New Wave films. And he really, I think, took a lot from them. But I would say that what Walter brought is really an awareness about using metaphor. You know, his father was an artist. Mm-hmm. So I feel like he was a painter. And I feel like they got it that he was really interested in sound. And so Walter got this recorder and he just started recording things and then cutting them together and rewinding them and slowing them down and just doing all these interesting things, really creating music out of everyday things. So, you know, George Lucas says he was really, Walter Murch was really making soundtracks the whole time.
Yeah. Yeah, and Walter won an Oscar for the sound mix that he did for Francis Ford Coppola's 1979 film, Apocalypse. Now, what innovations did Walter create for the sound design of this film?
Here, Walter, Mark Berger, and Richard Beggs, who are all the mixers on Apocalypse Now, they had only worked on mono films before this. So when you think of the great film, Walter also did the sound on The Godfather. Mm-hmm. When that first came out in theaters, people were hearing that mono. So Francis was in the Philippines shooting Apocalypse Now, and he heard this record by Tomita, and it was a four-track. So you're supposed to sit in the room, have four speakers in each corner, and then listen to this music. And he was so blown away by that, he said to Walter, "I want my movie to sound like this." And they ended up creating what we hear now, which is 5.1 sound. So it's left, center, right, you know, left surround, right surround, and then this boom track. And they essentially created that, which now, you know, 40 years later is the standard, you know, really since like the 80s.
Everything that we see and hear at the beginning of Apocalypse Now is being filtered through the consciousness of Martin Sheen's character, Captain Willard. Can you talk a bit about how this idea plays out on the soundtrack?
Oh, it's so great. So that whole first scene, you think you see, you know, you see the jungle and it bursts into flames and you hear the doors start. This is the end.
Yeah.
And you're in this room, very, you know, close up of Willard in the room and then in bed, like sleeping. And you think we're in the jungle because of you're hearing the jungle soundtrack.
Yeah.
And then you hear a helicopter. But what we're seeing is that it's in sync with the fan over his head. You hear the helicopter kind of going overhead, and just as he gets to the window, and then it passes by, and then you look, and it's like, he goes, oh, Saigon, you know?
Yeah.
And you realize, oh, he's in Saigon. That was all in his head. It's just a beautiful Saigon dance of this whole, you know, what's going on, and really puts us in his head, and then brings us right to the present day, like when he opens the blinds to look, we also come into like, oh, it's the city, it's Saigon.
There's this great clip from Walter in which he says that if you run music all the time in a film, it has a cumulatively counterproductive effect, constantly interjecting steroids. But if you want unrelieved tension, don't use any music at all. And that, of course, in your film leads into an exploration of how Alfred Hitchcock didn't use any music at all. Well, just a little bit of source music in The Birds. Can you talk about what Hitchcock did instead?
Oh, yeah. So Hitchcock, he would actually write out kind of a script for each reel, which is what we do. You know, we sit down and do that. So he did that as a director. So what he did was he used, they created the sounds of the birds. And it was really the bird sounds that become, just like Music Concrète, you know, become mm-hmm. like the soundtrack that scare the hell out of you. That clip that we use where Tippi Hedren's coming into the room, it's so quiet, like you don't even hear the doorknob. I really questioned, oh my God, should we use this? But that's perfect because that's exactly what he wants. It's like you do absolutely no sound, so you're leaning forward, and then she looks up and you hear her breath, and then the wings of the birds come at you, and you're just like, you just want to duck.
You also taught to Ben Burtt, who has worked as a sound designer on the Star Wars film series, the Indiana Jones series, and Ben was creating sound effects in the mid-1970s for the first Star Wars film. How did he create sound effects for things like, say, the Millennium Falcon?
Well, what George Lucas asked and talked to Ben about is that he wanted all real sounds. So Ben was going out and actually recording like jets taking off, and because he wanted that real feel. But he also wanted not everything to sound new, and he definitely didn't want it to sound synthesized like everything was done through kind of creating it. He wanted it to have like a feel too, that there was some age to it, so that you could just hear the engines in it. He would layer things, so he would put things on the synthesizer, so he would record like a regular jet sound, but then it'd have all these other sounds, and sometimes he used his own voice in things, and so he would just layer up things. And also, animals are a big part of what we do. It's like kind of slowed down animal sounds or even reversed or whatever. And in some ways, it's because the animal, you know, is just something that we can relate to as a human being. We don't identify it as part of the soundtrack, but we respond, I think, to it.
Well, animal sounds, appropriately enough, Ben used animal sounds to create the voice for Chewbacca, the Wookiee. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so that's one of my favorite parts in the film because Richard Anderson, who he was at film school with, and they were good buddies, they went out together to record they tried a lot of different animals, and they were trying to find something that would work, that could also have some variance to it that would sound like it was a language. So one day they recorded this young bear, a cub, named Pooh. The way that they got him to make sounds is that he liked bread dunked in milk or something, and then they'd show it to him, and then he'd want it, and then he'd kind of cry out for it, and then they'd give him the bread, and then he'd make these great sounds.
Let's talk a bit about the digital age of sound design for movies. One of the people you talked to is Gary Rydstrom, who's worked on many, many movies, including Toy Story. How has this digital age that we're in now, the computer age, how has that changed the way people like Gary create sound for cinema?
I have to say, when we switched from analog to digital, digital was great because you have so much flexibility. There's so many things you can do, changing pitch, changing, you know, speed, and it's just really working with frequencies. And also you can layer things, so you don't just hear one thing at a time, but you can hear all these things together. And that's really important, not just guessing what will they sound like together, and not waiting to get to the mix stage to mix them together, but really that you can take layers and layers of things, but manipulate them, you know, in so many different ways. And Gary does, I mean, amazing things. The thing is, sometimes it's the simplest thing. Like, I love that in the John Lasseter film, which now has become also the Pixar logo, that light, that sound for it, it's the little, you know, springs, and you could change the pitch on that, and it could make it sound like this little light is happy, and it's this little happy sound, and then it can be sad by the pitch going down at the end. And he just was able to manipulate these sounds in that way and make it, give it a language that we relate to.
Mitch Costin, thank you very much.
Thank you, Doug. It's been great.
Mitch Kostin on her documentary, Making Waves, The Art of Cinematic Sound. Find out more about Midge and sound in film at wpr.org/beta. That does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, John Hodgman, Sheila Weller, and Midge Kostin. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta podcast via Apple Podcasts or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week.
All it takes is a phone and an open mind.
Online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta.
Why aren't you calling?
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Production. Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
I don't know where you get your delusions, laser brain.
Our executive producer, nay, showrunner, is Adam Friedrich.
I don't know who you are or where you came from. From now on, you do as I tell you, okay?
And thanks to you, our alphas. We'll see you next week. I'm Doug Gordon.
Will somebody get this big walking carpet out of my way?